Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to the Milk the Clock podcast, lucky number, episode number 32. I'm Michael Stevenson, joined always by my buddy Ryan Music. Rye Dog, what are you up to?
You know, nothing much. Just kicking back. Got the Laker game on versus the Cavs in the background on mute. But other than that, you know, enjoyed a nice, tasteful, delicious dinner with Mexican Riviera. And I got no complaints, man. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm watching the game as well. LeBron, Kobe. We'll see what happens. I mean, the Lakers are up right now. Who knows what happens when the Lakers are on TV these days. But anyways, shoot me a layup line. Let's get this thing started.
All right, man. Let's go ahead and start it off with what was pretty much the news of the day with the Ohio State quarterback. Cardale Jones made the big announcement that he will be going back to school and returning to Ohio State and not entering the draft for at least another year. Was this the right decision?
Tough to say. I think he's definitely got the size to be an NFL quarterback once he's 6'5", 230, coming off a national championship. Yes, he did only play in three games. They were three of the biggest games, arguably, of the season for any team. He led them there. He chose to come back, which is a shocker to me because this is the same kid before the season who tweeted out, "I didn't come here to play school." So he's coming back for another year. We'll see who's going to start. Urban Meyer's got a big decision on his hands. J.T. Barrett, we know he got injured, but that guy was a Heisman candidate until up to that point. And Braxton Miller, he was one of the best players coming into the season, and unfortunately he didn't get to play any of the year. Who's going to transfer? Who's going to start? Urban Meyer's got a lot on his plate right now. Right decision? I don't know if it's the right decision because I don't think Cardale Jones' ceiling could get any higher than it is right now playing three games. I know it's a small sample size, but hey, three games, you played the best you could and you won a national championship. I thought he should have moved on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you said a lot of the things perfectly. It's tough to say if it's the right decision because that's something we won't really be able to know until we know the end-all, be-all of the story for Cardale Jones. But the small sample size was definitely just about the only thing holding him back in terms of draft stock. I mean, he not only played well in those three games, but as you said, he did it on the biggest stage in winning a conference championship game and then two playoff games. So in the three games that he did play, you couldn't really ask for much else out of him. But all I have to say is the fact that he did choose to go back to school, I mean, I'm going to be rooting for this kid, absolutely. I want him to succeed. And that's not to say I don't want success for Braxton Miller or JT Barrett, but college sports have suffered in the sense that obviously not so much in college football, but college basketball, unfortunately you lose a lot of top prospects to the professional ranks. So I think it's great that someone, one of these athletes actually made the choice to go back to school, continue his education. And I'm excited for what the future holds for this kid because as of right now, it seems like the sky's the limit.
Yeah, what a very unique circumstance because this guy really doesn't know if he's going to come back and start next year. The other guys that came back the next season, I mean, you see the Matt Leinarts of the world, they knew they had the stability. They were going into a spot where they knew they were going to start. And Cardale Jones, in this case, is going to be battling with two other phenomenal athletes and football player, so that's what makes it unique. Who knows if he's going to start. But either way, he's going to college, and he's probably going to end up with a great degree. Moving on to the next layup line, my Dukies, man, my Duke Blue Devils, you texted me on Sunday. They got upset against North Carolina State on the road, and then really unlike the Mike Krzyzewski coach team, they come back on Tuesday at home and lose to the Miami Hurricanes, snapping a 41-game winning streak in conference at home. Coach K is at 997 wins right now, three away from cracking the 1,000 mark. His next four games are at Louisville on Saturday, very tough game. Then they go to Pitt, or they're at home against Pitt, and then two tough road games at St. John's, at Notre Dame. When does Coach K crack the 1K?
I think it might take him up until that Notre Dame game. The fact that they have to play on the road against Louisville. Now, you can look at it two ways. Either they're playing on the road after losing two games in a row, so you could expect them to come out with a lot of fire, knowing that this is practically a must-win for them in the sense that you don't want to drop three straight conference games. But that's a tough Louisville team, which plays well at home. So if they drop that game, I see them still pulling it together and probably winning three straight over Pitt, St. John, and Notre Dame. So I think somehow with the combination of the next four games, he will get that 1,000th win.
Yeah, it was really a shocker to see them lose at home against Miami coming off a loss at North Carolina State, where they've lost before. They lost last year at North Carolina State. It's a tough place to play. At this point, anywhere in the ACC is tough to play. I'm going to say they win three straight. It's just hard for me to believe that a Coach K team will drop their third straight game Saturday. I know Louisville's tough. I know it's on the road. I know they're starting three freshmen. But Coach K is one of the greatest coaches that's ever lived, and I'm confident that he's going to get his 100K at St. John's against Steve Lavin, which should be a great, great basketball game.
Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see, you know. I hope for your sake that they pull it off in three straight games, because if they lose at Louisville, I don't really know if I'm going to want to hang out with you this weekend. But
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Yeah, definitely not. But this next layup line, we got MLB making their way back into the headlines. Bud Selig announced that they are going to implement a pitch clock in the AA and AAA leagues this year. And we think that after the model they've used in the past, that means that pitchers will have 20 seconds to pitch with runners on base and about 12 seconds with no runners on base. Do you think this is a step in the right direction for possibly speeding up the game of baseball? Or are you just a purist and you don't think that there needs to be any change?
I don't think this is the right way to speed up the game. I'm a lot more on the old school side of baseball. I do think there's ways to speed up the game, not putting a clock up there for pitchers to look at and to worry about. I saw it being used in the Arizona Fall League this year. It didn't really make much of a difference. Pitchers were getting rid of the ball. You know, it wasn't an issue. And that could be the case in the MLB. I know Red Sox-Yankee games do tend to go 5 hours long on a Sunday night when there's nothing else on TV. I've watched those games. I've sat through the 5 hours because I'm a loser and I like baseball that much. But I do think there's other things that are slowing the game down. And one, I've heard of the MLB talking about these certain things that have slowed it down. And one of them's, how about keeping the batters, have them keep 1 foot in the batter's box at all times. Because these guys are walking around after every pitch, you know, fixing their batting gloves, pulling up their socks. It's pretty ridiculous to me. I know you've probably seen it before. I know the Dodgers have had plenty of players like that. Handler Ramirez was one of them. He's no longer on the team, but he would walk around after a pitch for, say, 10 seconds that you're trying to, you know, now have the pitcher get rid of the ball in that time. I think the hitters have a lot to do with it, and I think that's one of the things MLB will look to change.
Yeah, definitely. I agree in the sense that there are several things that MLB could do in order to speed up the pace of play, but I'm definitely in favor of this pitch clock. I just think that at some point they need to implement at least something and get the ball rolling in the direction of speeding up the game because, like you said, you love baseball and you don't mind watching a four-hour game or a five-hour game, whatever it may be. But I think if baseball wants to at least begin to chip away at the gap between the NBA and the NFL in terms of national popularity, they're going to want to get games to start averaging just under 3 hours a game. I think if they can get right to about 3 hours or just under 3 hours for an average game, I think that they would do a lot better in terms of holding a larger fan base.
You know why I love baseball so much, though? They're not playing against
yeah.
the clock.
It's a good
and,
point.
I mean, I do love baseball probably more than most people. I watched a 15-inning Dodger game this year against the Nationals on a Wednesday at 12 o'clock p.m., so that'll tell you everything. But I do like that there's no clock. And I'm telling you, this pitching thing, it might be a bigger deal if you put it at the MLB, level, but AAA and AA, I don't know, because I saw it in the Arizona Fall League, and it was just another thing added on to the scoreboard at your left or right-hand corner of your TV. Anyways, moving on to the last layup line, I'm ready to talk some NBA. There's a three-team trade that just went through today between the Clippers, Suns, and Celtics, and Austin Rivers ended up in Los Angeles playing for his dad, Doc Rivers. Initial thoughts when you heard this?
Quite honestly, other than it seemed like a very uninteresting way to put a, for the first time in NBA history fact, in the sense that a son playing for his father for the first time in NBA history, I don't really see what this did for any of the teams involved. I mean, especially the Clippers. I mean, I know that they're trying to find, quote-unquote, the missing piece to sort of get themselves over the hump into one of the top three teams in the West or East with the Hawks playing so well, but we can get into that later. But I just don't really see if Austin Rivers is really the person that you're trying to pick up right before the All-Star break that's going to get you over the hump into one of the upper echelon teams in the NBA right now.
Yeah, I've seen Austin Rivers. I saw him play his freshman year at Duke. I thought he should have came back and played some more years. He's still developing as a player at the highest level, which is tough to do. And this isn't going to move the needle much at all for the Clippers. They waived Jordan Farmar. They got rid of Chris Douglas Roberts in this trade, who wasn't in the rotation. Reggie Bullock, who's actually, I think this guy could be a solid player. He just never was worked in the rotation as well. This guy's 6'6". Good wing defender and a pretty good three-point shooter, he'll probably end up being a solid NBA player. At this point, no one really knows what Austin Rivers could do. He can handle it. He can play the one. You know, he's not a lights-out jump shooter like a Jamal Crawford who the Clippers already have. Maybe the Clippers are going to let him play the point guard position at this point because, you know, they just waived Farmar, so that leaves that spot open in the second unit. Maybe he can create for other people. All I'm saying is, I watched the Pelicans game last week or the week before, and he wasn't even in their rotation. He played 2 minutes, and that was at the beginning of a fourth-quarter game, but the game wasn't close. So what does that tell you about Austin Rivers? He's coming to a contender now. I don't know how the son-dad thing's going to play in the NBA. I think these guys are mature enough to know, you know, that that's not going to be too big of a deal, but I don't think the needle. I don't think it's going to move the needle at all as far as Western Conference teams working their way up to the standings. But I'm going to jump right into some NBA talk because we really haven't got into it. But now we're headed into the bulk of the NBA season. And you mentioned it a little bit already. Those Atlanta Hawks, they're 31-8 right now. They're at the top of the Eastern Conference. I know the Eastern Conference is weak, but this Hawks team could play. And you know what they are? They're the Spurs of the East. That's what they are. You probably couldn't name one or two players on that team. Most people can't. But they have a guy like Tim Duncan. Al Horford doesn't say much, but he'll tear it up in game. He just had his first career triple-double a couple days ago, and no one probably heard about it. And my favorite nickname of this Atlanta Hawks team, they got a guy named Kyle Korver on the team.
Oh, God.
Who rains threes, one of the best three-point shooters in the league the last couple of years. Him and Horford together, what do you get? Horford.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty good, but let's not forget who's probably one of the best, also one of the best players on that Hawks team, which is just absolutely tearing it up right now, and that's Jeff Teague. I mean, this guy's just an absolute monster out there, but definitely with a player like Al Horford down in the paint, and then you have someone like Korver around the three-point line just making it rain. I think I heard somewhere that he might have the top field goal percentage. If not, he's near the top in the league for three-point percentage. And then I believe Jeff Teague at the point just running the show and making it rain as well because he's a great shooter. You know, that Hawks team, they're quietly making themselves a number one seed in the East this year, filling in for, you know, obviously the Pacers are having a down year. Cavaliers aren't anywhere as good as what people thought that they could have been so far. They're struggling big time, which is another, you know, a big story to get into. I mean, I've been a big proponent of, you know, pump the brakes a little bit on this Cavs team and the fact that they need to be great right away. But now we're getting closer and closer to the All-Star break. I mean, granted, you know, you still don't want to blow things out of proportion because they are in the East. And I believe right now they're still in, like, sixth place. But the fact of the matter is, but the fact of the matter is they're 19-20. I mean, and I know LeBron's been out, and he's just recently returned, and they lost Anderson Varejao. They now have J.R. Smith, and they got rid of Dion Waiters. But if they barely make – let's say they go in as a sixth seed. I mean, and I don't even know who the three seed is right now. Who's the third-place team in the East? I mean, who would be a possible first-round matchup for them right now?
Washington or Toronto.
Washington or Toronto. Right, yeah. And as of right now, I would bet on them over the Cavaliers just based off what I've seen. It's Toronto. And by the way, Toronto's playing, and they just got DeMar DeRozan back. I mean, Toronto definitely looks like the better team. Now, realistically, if I had to bet a large sum of money, it's pretty hard to bet against LeBron James, especially in crunch time. But, I mean, this Cavaliers team, at some point, you're going to wonder, like, okay, are they actually going to be able to turn it around? Because there have been instances where Kevin Love hasn't even played really in the fourth quarter of close games because he's a defensive liability. So if Kevin Love leaves after this year, I mean, now you're back to what? Now you just have LeBron, Kyrie, and they traded for Timofey Mozgov? I mean, who knows? This quote-unquote dream team could fall apart as quick as the Lakers did.
No, it's a scary situation. And you mentioned the Lakers. That went south really quick when they had Dwight Howard and Steve Nash. You know, I really don't know what to make of it because it really starts at the top with David Blatt. Does he have respect of his players? I'm not going to dissect it like I've seen on Twitter with, you know, LeBron not paying attention in huddles, shoving David Blatt. You know, that was clearly to avoid a technical. Everyone blew it up like, oh, LeBron doesn't have respect. LeBron once pushed Eric Spoelstra, and that turned out two championships, four straight finals appearances. So you can, you know, cut it up to however you want. They have the talent, but I think at some point, maybe the All-Star break, they have to look at this and say, can we go forward with David Blatt as a head coach? And they need to ask LeBron that question. I said this a couple weeks ago on our podcast. LeBron knows best that this team's going to make it or not because he's been in this situation before. You have to go to him and say, do you think David Blatt's the guy? If he's not, say, LeBron, tell us right now because we need to bring someone else in because we want to win a championship. It's that easy. You know, it's easier said than done, but that's what they need to do. I don't think the Hawks get enough credit, which is sad. I mean, that's why I called them the Spurs of the East. And they might not have that headline guy, but if you watch the way they play, it's a phenomenal system. And Mike Budenholzer, who I want to mention, because he came from the San Antonio Spurs staff, you look at what that team's doing, and I'm not a great coach. I've coached two seasons of seventh grade basketball. I talked about this last year. But I always mention this one thing that I got from Popovich because I love the way they play. People would say it's boring, but the fastest thing on the court is the basketball. If you pass that ball well, people aren't going to be able to catch up to that thing, and you're going to leave the man open. And that's the way the Hawks play. Paul Millsap, Horford, Jeff Teague, and Korver, and Damari Carroll, that's a solid five right there. You don't need the LeBron Jameses of the world. I believe the Hawks are not just the best team in the East. I think they can compete to actually win an NBA championship this year if they play well enough down the stretch. They've won 10 straight now, but who knows? Now, I want to ask you a question because we're coming up on the All-Star break, and there's already been trades, you know, that have shifted the entire conferences. One was Rondo headed to Dallas, who was already one of the top teams in the West. And you add a guy like Rondo to that team, you're only going to get better. He has championship experience. And another one that was just recently a three-team trade that had Jeff Green go to Memphis, which I absolutely love, is that team over the past couple years really couldn't create offense off the dribble besides throwing it to the post and Marc Gasol and Zach Randolph. And you could beat up, you know, guys down at the post, but how long can you do that for? You need presence on the wing, and I think Jeff Green is the perfect guy for a third or fourth option on that basketball team.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. And the Grizzlies have been near the top of the Western Conference all season long, battling And, you know, with the elevated play of Mike Connolly, they definitely, like every other year, you know, they're practically in it right until, you know, the Western Conference Championship, and they just haven't been able to close out those tight games in a playoff situation for the reason, as you said, they can't have someone to create off the dribble. So they lose to a team like the Thunder, who has the Kevin Durant or the Russell Westbrook, to be able to drive the lane or make something happen when you need a bucket with, you know, 30 seconds left on the clock. But just one quick thing before we wrap up the NBA, just something to look out for. I mean, the Boston Celtics have, like you said, they got rid of both Jeff Green and Rondo in trades, and it's just going to be absolutely insane to watch this team over the next couple of years, because they have now locked up 9 first-round draft picks through the 2018 draft. I mean, it's just going to be crazy to see what this team's going to even look like, because with that many first-round draft picks, you're bound to grab a franchise-changing player. So just really interested to see what the Celtics are going to do with all those draft picks moving forward.
And let me mention one more thing. I've been saying this for a while now, but all I want to say is the Celtics are doing it the right way and the Lakers are not. Sad to say, but true.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll just see what the future holds for the Boston Celtics. But let's hit the halftime reach really quick. Last week, I made the prediction about the kickoff return for Oregon to win the championship. Clearly didn't happen. OSU, the Ohio State, they laid it on pretty thick there at the end. And also another halftime reach that I forgot to recap was I said that there was going to be a Super Bowl rematch of last year with the Denver Broncos and the Seattle Seahawks. Broncos are out, so that won't be happening, but Seahawks still have a shot. And for this week, I have Eddie Lacy is going to do some running on that Seattle D. He's going to score 2 touchdowns and go for 150, but I think Seahawks still pull off the win.
Wow, still pull off the win. Hey, I like that. I'm going to say the king of the neckbeard, not myself, but Andrew Luck throws 4 touchdowns, throws for 300 yards, outplays Tom Brady, and you know what? Indy's going to the Super Bowl.
Whoa! All right. I mean, hey, no one gave him a shot against the Broncos, so, I mean, might as well just shock the world in back-to-back games. But let's hit the NFL real quick. I mean, we've talked about before, Rex Ryan got the head coaching job with the Buffalo Bills. There have been some other additions since then. John Fox was actually a quote-unquote mutual parting of ways with the Denver Broncos and John Elway. And now he is considered one of the favorites for the Chicago job. But actual hires, which have already been official, is the Jets got Todd Bowles, former defensive coordinator with the Arizona Cardinals. Oakland hired Jack Del Rio, defensive coordinator for the Denver Broncos. And the San Francisco 49ers, in a shocking turn of events, hired Jim Tomsula, the offensive line coach or defensive line coach, one of the two, for the 49ers. So they kept it in-house and promoted him. But when you get rid of someone like Jim Harbaugh and you replace him with sort of an unknown coach, I mean, that's definitely not something that people expected the 49ers to end up going with. I mean, you would have thought that they would have brought in someone like, you know, maybe a John Fox, or a lot of people are talking about Dan Quinn with the Seattle Seahawks. Obviously, they're still in the playoffs, so they're not able to really give him the job just yet. But I was surprised to see that they gave Jim Tomsula the job, because it just really was not the big name that you would have expected the 49ers to land.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't the big name, but you saw Jim Harbaugh and Jed York, you know, at the top of that franchise, butting heads for whatever reasons, and I think that's why they kept it in-house. They obviously know each other. He's been there for a long time now in that 49ers organization, And Jed York probably said, I know this guy. I know I'm going to be able to make my decisions, and he's going to do his coaching on the field with the players I want. So I think it really has a lot to do with player evaluation and knowing who this guy is and the relationship they've had for quite some time. The other hires, Todd Bowles, can't really, you know, make any predictions because he's never coached. It will be interesting to see these first-time head coaches become a head coach, because you're not just dealing with the defensive line or, you know, an entire defense. At this point, you're dealing with 53 grown men, which is a tough thing to do. Some people aren't made to be head coaches because they can't relate to 53 guys. So that's why you can't really speculate of what's going to happen in New York, what's going to happen in Frisco. We could actually kind of speculate what's going to happen in Oakland, because Jack Del Rio was the coach in Jacksonville for quite some time. I think, you know, 8 years, I believe. And we know how that franchise has gone. I think Del Rio is a great coach, but I do think Oakland needs to do something with their GM. I don't think Reggie McKenzie has done anything to earn his spot. So we'll see what happens. I want to dive right into these championship games in the AFC. Tom Brady, Andrew Luck, Colts, Patriots in New England. I think I already put myself out there as picking the Colts, so I guess I'm going to have to ride that one. But I think it's going to be tough to beat Tom Brady at this point. He played a heck of a game against Baltimore. We talked about how great of a football game that was. Brady stepped up. He's been playing better than ever. And Andrew Luck, that Colts team overall has stepped up defensively, offensive line. People were talking about all year how they're kind of a good, bad team. They show up against the bad opponents, but when they play a good team, they kind of fold. And that hasn't been the case in these first two rounds of the playoffs. And all power to them, they actually have a shot and believe they could go into Foxborough and win on Saturday. So I'm taking the Colts in that one. And the game against the Packers and Seahawks, it's really simple. How limited is Aaron Rodgers going to be? I know in the fourth quarter against the Cowboys, he went 9 of 9, didn't throw an incomplete pass, really torched them. But I think the Seahawks defensive line has to get after this guy, make him run under the pocket, which I think that's where he plays best. But if his calf, you know, something happens in that thing, you get a piece of it while you're tackling him, this game could change for the worse, and I think that's the advantage the Seahawks have. They have to get after Rodgers, and they have to run the ball down the Packers' throat, which they did in the first week of the season when the NFL kicked off.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you put it perfectly. The problem with the Cowboys was they didn't put enough pressure on Aaron Rodgers and allowed him to stay within the pocket, which we all know how great he is. But the reason Aaron Rodgers can be so deadly is because of the fact that he can also kill you while being mobile. But the Cowboys didn't really force him to be mobile, and obviously with the calf injury, he's not going to be as effective on the run as he normally is. So I imagine the Seahawks have a strong enough secondary with their DBs and their safeties that they can maybe stack the box a little bit, send out a pretty heavy blitz package onto Rodgers, and force him to have to move a little bit. And at least if you're not actually getting a direct result of a sack or a tackle for loss or a knockdown, at least if you're forcing Aaron Rodgers to roll out of the pocket and try and throw on the run, you have a lot better shot than allowing him to stay immobile, not use that calf as much, and just air it out from the protection of his offensive line. So I definitely think that I'm going to stick with the Seahawks on that game. Going back over to the AFC, I mean, what an incredible game that was between the Patriots and the Ravens. But something that I feel like kind of went overlooked was the fact that the Patriots had 14 rushing yards. I mean, that's just crazy to think that they set a record for fewest amount of rushing yards in a playoff win. So I think if the Patriots could run the ball a little bit better off of against a defense that is not nearly as good as the Baltimore Ravens and the Indianapolis Colts, I think the Patriots should not have a problem beating the Colts. But then again, you know, it's NFL playoffs. If the Colts step up and show up and play like they have been playing so far, there's no reason that they don't have a fighter's chance against the Patriots. So I'm not saying that this is going to be a blowout, but I feel like if the Patriots can play as well as they did against the Ravens on top of having a better rushing game, I mean, there's a reason why they have Tom Brady at the helm, and he can be pretty tough to beat in clutch situations. But
and
that
not
now
to,
brings
not,
us up.
Not,
oh, yeah,
wait,
go ahead.
Not to mention, the last time the Patriots played the Colts earlier this season, Jonas Gray rushed for 4 touchdowns. So that gives you a little glimpse of how their rushing game might work.
Yeah, so we'll definitely see. You know, Belichick, he always comes up with those masterful game plans. So definitely going to be a very interesting NFL weekend. And really the last one for a couple weeks until we have, you know, the big Super Bowl in February. So definitely looking forward to it. That brings us up to the final possession. I'll make this quick. Music brings the ball up the court, dishes the corn with 3 seconds to go. Stevenson with the shot.
All right, this one might get a little weird. NASCAR driver Kurt Busch took his ex-girlfriend to court because he believes she's a trained assassin. I know you saw this headline. When I saw it, I don't even know where my mind was going. I thought it was a joke. I thought The Onion had wrote it. But this is real stuff. This is on trial. He says that she showed up one night, took off her jacket, and she had a blood-scattered gown on. And he thinks she's a trained assassin. Now, I don't know where he's going to find his chicks, but a trained assassin, man. I don't know what I'd do if I was dating a trained assassin. I'd probably talk a lot of crap to people outside of bars and stuff and have her with me right there. I don't know what I'd do. I mean, it's a sketchy situation. She's a good-looking girl, but, in my opinion, she's a keeper. Who knows what she's going to do once they get out of court one day. I don't know. I'm freaked out about it. I'm scared for Kurt. This could be serious business. just the title, Trained Assassin, I've never heard anything like it before. I heard of the game Assassin's Creed, but I never heard of someone actually mean a trained assassin.
Oh, you didn't know that Assassin's Creed was based off a true story? It's based off Kurt Busch's ex-girlfriend.
Clearly. This is nuts. I mean, she's claiming Kurt Busch is making this story up like it's a movie about to be made. It's bizarre. Anyways, that's all we got for Milk the Clock Podcast, Episode 32. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Hit us up on Twitter. I'm at MCS Gotcha. That's MCSGOTCHA. Music, you know what to do.
Definitely, man. And hit me up on Twitter at Music Reports. That is MUSICK Reports. And we're looking forward to seeing you guys next week. That's all we got for episode 32. Milk it.